Well, let's go ahead and get started. Thank you for taking your time out of a very busy and fruitful week here. Amazing. Mike Hope was saying last night about Ruth and sort of the mundane, if you will, like the common being. You might say it. It's too bad that the common is not more common.
That's common, yes.
If Boaz and Ruth are common, yeah. So, wow. Jared, I don't envy you tomorrow. Jared is going to be talking, giving some ideas. Wow, how do you do this? It is amazing to me, as much as I do biblical studies, the more I do, the more I know, the more that I realize I don't know. And every single time I look at this stuff, I find God saying, oh, did you notice this? This as well. It's just, my students don't get it yet. I wish they did. Because they would just, there's just so much. So, a year ago, I changed, some of you may have heard this last year, but last spring, a year ago, I changed one of the classes that I do every other year. It's called World of the Old Testament. And it's supposed to introduce students to all of the background stuff. You know, and I had done it in the typical way. Last year I thought, why don't we just do a case study? And I started off preparing as my first case study out of half a dozen. I started with Ruth, and in the process of preparing it, I came to realize I could do the entire semester on Ruth. And when we got done, many of the students said, yeah, but what about this question? And what about this idea that I see in the book? And what about this characteristic of Boaz and this characteristic of Ruth? And it just goes on and on and on. So, you know, so that was, what, 40-something hours of Ruth. And we're talking about an hour and a half here and kind of just scratching the surface. So, wow, it's just amazing what God has done in His work. So, a little bit of review from yesterday. As I said, yesterday we were focusing more on Ruth, and so I had Ruth and Boaz. Today we're kind of getting a little bit more of a male perspective. Even though this one has the name of a woman on the book, there's something in it for the guys too. Okay, I won't. Anyway, so yesterday we were talking about family values. Family values in the Old Testament and getting some insights there. And just a little bit, the importance, the value we talked about yesterday, the value that is placed on a name. I thought this would come to me, but it didn't. There was a movie several years ago starring Ralph Fiennes about I guess it's Quiz Show. That's what it was, Quiz Show. You guys remember that one? Mm-hmm. Quiz Show? I don't know if you've ever seen it. Yeah, you should go watch that. It's a true story. Based on quiz shows from, I guess, the late 50s. And there was one where the main character, Ralph Fiennes, his character in the story, came from a very well-known intellectual family. Oh, yeah. And he came onto the show and won more money than anybody had ever won before. But what came out was, even he, along the way, was being fed at least the questions, if not the answers. And there's this important scene toward the end where he finally confesses this to his father. And he's trying to say, oh, come on, Dad, it's going to go away. You know, it's just a passing fad. People will forget about this. And the father says, yes, but it's my name. And the son wants to say, oh, it's just a name. No, it's my name. It's a name, you know, reputation. what you are remembered for is very important. And that's a part of this, is name. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But also, it has to do with property rights. Someone who has a name is worthy, if you will, noble enough to own property. Because that's also with name comes responsibilities. So you're responsible enough, you're noble enough, you have the character for God to give you the responsibility of taking care of this little part of his creation. That's a part of having a name. So it talks about in, for example, we mentioned the book of Numbers yesterday, that the land of Israel, what they shall inherit, is divided according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. So who has a name? Do you maintain? Do you keep up? Do you establish? Do you have a place for? That word maintain a name, it's a verb, kum, which is the root of the word for place. So a place has a particular name. Is your name on that place? Sort of thing. Right, so you have your own place, your own space, with your name on it. What is it known for? Is it a Sodom and Gomorrah? Or is it a Bethlehem? Sort of thing. All right. So that's an important thing. And we'll see that today because we're going to be looking at Boaz and who has a name here. But also, as Mike mentioned last night, Ruth is known as and Boaz tells her this, she is a woman of noble character. He says, that's the way the people are talking about you. And that famous love scene, at the threshing floor in chapter 3. People know you as a woman of noble character. And as Mike pointed out, I don't know if you caught this, but in many Hebrew Bibles, the way that they arrange the books, none of them put Ruth in between Judges and 1 Samuel. That's something that the Greek translators later did in the Inheritance. So a lot of it is that they put Ruth later with these megaloths. And in some cases, they put Ruth as the first one after Proverbs. So in Proverbs, the last chapter of Proverbs, it ends with the description of the woman of noble character, Proverbs 31:10. And in the next book, here you have a story about the only other woman we know of who has that label on her in the Old Testament. Okay? So she's a noble character. Now, as Mike also pointed out, though, Boaz has the same label. Now, they translate it different. I don't know why. The translation, at least in the NIV, is he's a man of standing, even though there's nothing about stand in the Hebrew word. It's noble character. He's a man of nobility. She's a woman of nobility. A fascinating thing. You can see why it applies to him, why an Israelite would feel very comfortable in describing Boaz, someone who has a name with property. Sure, he's a man of nobility. But to call Ruth a Moabite widow as a woman of nobility, that's a bit of a stretch. But she deserves it. And we talked yesterday about why. So now, though, we're going to talk about how Boaz lives up to his name. Right. Yes, sir?
Is that where we get ruthless? People who are
sorry.
I appreciate the spirit of that. I don't think. I think it comes from something else. So a little bit about context. And boy, here's where I wish we had much, much more time. To consider Judges 19. All right. First of all, Bethlehem, small town. Not too far away, close proximity to Jerusalem before it was Israelite Jerusalem. David is the one who takes over the city of Jerusalem. Before that, it's the Jebusites. Do you know what the story is that begins in Judges 19? You know, it's
It's no surprise. A lot of our children in their, you know, elementary age in Sunday school, you'll hear some of the stories of the book of Judges. You'll hear about Gideon and the fleece. You'll hear about Deborah, you know, Caleb, and all, you know, Othniel, all these guys. Samson, everybody loves long-haired Samson, right? But nobody that I know of in their right mind is going to teach elementary age kids about Judges 19, especially Judges 19, followed by 20 and 21. But Judges 19 is a story about, get this, a woman from Bethlehem who gets married to a guy from Ephraim. They have a little squabble. She goes back home to Bethlehem for a little while. He goes after her. When they go start to go back home, it's getting close to nightfall. They're going by Jerusalem, and the Israelite man says, oh, there's no way we're going to stop in Jerusalem. There's just a bunch of Jebusites, foreigners there. No telling how they might treat us. And so they go on to the next town, Israelite town, north of there, where the people there are just horrible to them. Okay, we have an example of gang rape and murder, and that leads to a civil war. Okay, they all did not live happily ever after. But it's an interesting contrast between that and what you read about with Boaz and Ruth. But that is sort of the context within which the story of Boaz and Ruth takes place. You're in a world where it is not unheard of to mistreat strangers, for example. You know, and who's going to stop you? That's kind of the world you live in. So you, what we know about from the book of Judges primarily is how the Israelite people are going back and forth between, are we going to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel, or are we going to worship some other gods of the people around us, like the Jebusites, those awful, awful people, who end up being probably better, in this case at least. Militarily, you go back and forth between, do you have a good judge or don't you, to lead you. Economic insecurity caused by these other people coming in from time to time, foreigners coming and taking some of their stuff. And then ethnic animosity, like you see in Judges. We can't trust those Jebusites. We can't trust those Moabites. Who knows what they might do to us or what we might do to them. You can't even trust people from a different tribe. And so the story of Boaz and Ruth just really, really stands out. Now also, as we mentioned yesterday, we're in a patriarchal society. The guys are in charge. Patrilineal inheritance goes from father to son to grandson. And patrimonial, they're in control of the money. The guys, the men, the fathers are in control of the money. So fathers know best. Like Boaz and like this other guy. So let's notice how Boaz is held up as such a strong positive contrast to the world around him. And that's why today it's my subtitle is In the World But Not of the World. So notice the world in which they live. And we'll go back and forth. So in the world, what do you have? Well, a part of the world in which they live is that brothers can inherit. In other words, sons. If you have multiple sons, you have brothers inheriting. And that causes some interesting moments. Now, we've gotten past this in our society. Notice the tongue in my cheek. We've gotten past this in our society because when, you know, parents pass away, their children very serenely and according to the law, without any quibbling whatsoever, without any hard feelings or resentment ever resulting, they divide up the property. Right? Well, back then, they had problems with those things from time to time. But it's kind of talked about, thought about in terms of the name. Because on the one hand, these guys, they know that they have an obligation to the name of their father and grandfather, and the house name, the clan name, the name of the tribe from which they come. they have an obligation to those existing, preceding names. But at the same time, they are guys, and they would like future generations to admire their name. And so if it's possible, you know, to make a name for themselves, they want to try to do that. So they have sort of, the, you know, they're sort of torn between respecting the names that are there and the names of the other people around them, but at the same time promoting their own name. So, you know, like I wonder, when these two guys come to Jesus and Luke, and one of them says, "Tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." Is that a move to try to distinguish yourself, to put your name, or give your name an advantage? So you kind of wonder what's going on there. Now, we talked about levirate marriage yesterday. That's what you have here in Ruth, where, like we see in several societies in the ancient Near East, and even modern societies, you know, current ones today, where you see this this business of wanting to carry on the name, make sure it stays intact. But what happens if a guy gets married, and before he and his wife have a child, the guy dies? Is his name cut off? Is that the end of the line for his line? And they have ways to keep the line going. And this is the main one, that the widow would marry her brother-in-law, and he would function as a proxy in place of his dead brother to carry on, maintain, establish the name of the brother. So what it does is, not only are you obligated to the name of your father and your own name, but you're having to maintain also not just your name, but the name of your dead brother. That idiot went off and died before he had any kids. Just like my brother to do something like that. In the handout, the example from Rwanda that we talked a little bit about yesterday, you can see how it's very natural for people to start coming up with reasons why the obligations don't fall to them, or why it's not reasonable to think that they should be able to fulfill their obligations. So that's kind of what you get with this guy, the closer relative, the redeemer, the kinsman redeemer, that Boaz confronts in Ruth chapter 4. He says, we got to deal with this. We got to, you know, take care of this technical, legal, custom matter before Boaz and Ruth can get married. And so he calls the elders, the guys who were supposed to oversee business deals, calls them together, then he calls in this other guy. And the other guy, at first, when he is confronted with his obligation, you know, it's like probably everybody knew that he would have to pick this up at some time, but until somebody confronts him with it and says, hey, what are you going to do about it? He's just going to let it go until he has to. So now Boaz says, hey, look, things are happening. He says something about Naomi selling the property, probably needs the money, just to kind of keep going, hoping things will change. And then the guy says, well, sure, I'll buy the property. We'll keep it in the clan, keep it among cousins or whatever. I'll do that. Yeah. Now, we're guessing here. I'll throw up a couple other guesses some of you suggested yesterday, but not exactly sure why. But then Boaz says, and of course, when you do this now, when you get this from Naomi, you've also got to take on the responsibility. You have to acquire Ruth with all of the privileges and responsibilities thereto appertaining. Get this degree. So at that point, he backs out, saying, I can't do this. I might endanger, I might harm, I might destroy my inheritance. So last night, listening to Mike, I thought, you know, this is rather interesting. You know, Mike talked for a minute about poloni alimony, which is just sort of nonsense words. in Hebrew. You know, Mr. So-and-so. Whoever. Mr.
Isn't that from the Flintstones?
Yeah. it's like you know, Charlie Brown and the adults talking. You don't. Nothing really comes out. So it's very interesting to me that here is a guy who is presented with the obligation, if you will, to maintain the name of Elimelech, Mahlon, Naomi, and Ruth's family. You know, that little twig, that little branch. He's given that obligation. When he's presented with it, he's concerned about maintaining his own name. And then what does the writer do? They don't tell you his name. It's like his name is forgettable. So in not honoring and, you know, bearing the burden, if you will, for somebody else's name, his own name just becomes forgotten.
I guess I wonder why, when Naomi arrives at Bethlehem, doesn't she go to him right away and say...
There's lots of little details like that.
She might know who he is.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, but the point is, she knows who he is. He may not be a nice guy.
And a lot of this, I wonder, so why did they wait until now? Why didn't they do it right away? So there must be something about how you go about these things that's involved. I mean, have you ever read about, you know, negotiations? You know, and it's funny how these things go, where the first person says, hey, let me just give you this property. You know, with Abraham, I'll just give it to you. And he says, oh, no, I got to pay you for it. And they go back and forth. So I wonder if there's something like that maybe going on. Anyway, it is interesting. And all this talk about names, we don't have this guy's
name. He's going to pay money to Naomi to buy the land, but if he has a child through Ruth, that land goes to the child, so he's lost part of his inheritance.
But why doesn't he automatically know that? Why does Boaz have to remind him? So, I don't know. So, here's the deal. See, I wonder, what is it that puts his own inheritance at risk? You can only kind of guess. The most obvious, you know, suggestion is that there's something about additional obligations, responsibilities, that it's just, you know, yeah, it's only going to cost this much now, but I'm going to have to pay interest on it later or something like that. Yeah. Down the line it's going to cost. Or would this mean that he would have to take care of Ruth's child, Naomi's, you know, that take care of him ahead of his own? So we don't know enough about his own family situation yet. Is he already married? Does he already have kids? We don't know. Is it going to mean he can't send his kid to college? Something like that. Or does he even have an heir to his name? Is he like Boaz and doesn't have? And this is what really makes Boaz's own action here so surprising. Does he have an heir to his own name? You see, when Boaz, who has property in his name, when he marries Ruth and raises up a child on behalf of Ruth's dead husband, that means Boaz's firstborn belongs to somebody else. What about his own property? What if they don't have any other children? Somebody mentioned this to me yesterday. Yeah, what if they don't have any other children? What happens to his property?
Books.
Does it go to her and Obed? Does he want that? Is he willing for that to happen? I mean, that may be a risk. And so it makes me think about, perhaps he's showing a strong self-sacrificial attitude in this, just like Ruth. So, and then in all of this, I've wondered, was this an acceptable out? In other words, do you present it to this kinsman knowing that he really doesn't want to take this on because of Ruth? But he's willing to do what is reasonable, right? Which is take on the responsibility for the property. make sure that Naomi is taken care of. Willing to do that. But, oh, this other thing, oh, that's asking even more. That's reasonable. It's understandable that he wouldn't want to take on that as well. So maybe it's a way of letting him save face, but at the same time then opening the door for Boaz. I don't know. Speculating. If we were lawyers back then, we'd know all these ins and outs. So just wonder. But in any case, it's clear that Boaz is willing to take a greater risk than this other guy. Now, quick little footnote. Please do not turn this into a business ethic of if you're going to be a good Christian, you're going to take risks right and left. That's what faith is. I've heard guys talk that way. Oh, I didn't invest in the riskier stocks where I could have made more money. That's what God wanted me to do. No, that's not what is being, when we're talking about risks here, he is making these risks because he sees the need and he's willing to take the risk in order to address the need, not because he thinks then God is going to enrich him even. It's not a selfish thing. Right, so, don't go there. Now, so I wonder, we talked a little bit yesterday, I'm going very, very fast here. We talked a little bit yesterday about hermeneutics and not preferring, we have this propensity for preferring certain passages, right? Sort of cherry picking. Notice that this other kinsman, first of all, when we think of work ethics, we think 2 Thessalonians 3. He who does not work shall not eat. All right? Good. 1 Timothy 5. Are you as familiar with this one? 1 Timothy 5. If a man will not take care of those of his own house, he is worse than an unbeliever. So you could say that this other kinsman was someone who was adhering to 1 Timothy 5:8. He wanted to make sure his own house was taken care of. That was his rationale. That was his excuse. I cannot help Ruth with her problem because I've got to take care of my own family. Do you see the kind of wisdom that is required in some of these things? Because, yeah, I mean, if in trying to take care of Ruth, he ends up making it impossible for everyone that he's supposed to be responsible for, that's not good. So, yeah, so how do you know? How do you know when you step out there on a little bit more faith? I don't know. Anyway, we need to be careful about just picking one verse and saying that is the principle for everything we're going to do in business, for everything we're going to do in work, for everything we're going to do in whatever. The Bible is more sophisticated than that. It's more intelligent than that. It understands variables, that there are variables. So now, think about this, though. Boy, I really want to... I'm throwing you guys a curveball at the end today. On the other hand, you got this, and you go, you got what? Yeah, you got Deuteronomy chapter 8. I wonder how much Boaz is influenced by the theology principle in the latter half, the second half of Deuteronomy chapter 8. All right? So let's see. We'll start in verse 10, and we'll skip a little bit and go down. We really need to get down to verse 17. Verse 10, when you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God and fail to observe his commands, his laws, his decrees I'm giving you today. And on he goes. Now, go down to verse 17. Do not say to yourself, all right, stop for a second. Do not say to yourself, in some of your translations, it'll say, do not say in your heart,
which translation?
ESV.
NSV.
ESV.
ESV. ESV.
That is a little bit more literal. Do not say in your heart. Now, I bring this up because in my classes, one of the things I do, I make sure I do this every year, is we focus on the greatest commandment. What is the greatest commandment? Love the Lord with all your heart. Heart. Well, what does that mean? Oh, I really love it. It's so cute. I just love it to death with all my heart. No. Yeah. So what I do is then I take them through the book of Deuteronomy saying, let's see how they use the word heart. And this is one of the examples. So if you love the Lord with all your heart, you're not going to say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hands, pulling myself up by my own bootstraps, have produced this wealth for me. If you love the Lord with all your heart, you're not going to say that. All right? But instead, you will remember that the Lord your God is He who is giving you the ability to produce wealth and so confirm His covenant with you. So I think that that's Boaz's attitude. In other words, he has the attitude of not this other guy who thinks, if I'm going to make it here, I'm really going to have to work hard. And if I just work hard and do things the right way, if I can control things, I will be wealthy. No. It is not your hard work. It is the fact that God has given you this. This is God's land. And He has given you responsibility for this part of it. But don't forget, this is God's land. And He is giving you wealth. He is prospering you because He said He would to those who keep His commandments. All right. See, there's a different attitude about how you get your wealth and how you're going to use your wealth. So I think Boaz has this different work ethic in him, that it's about using the gifts that God has given you and remembering that what you have truly is a gift from God. And so when these needs come up, if at all possible, you're going to find a way to address these needs. All right? So there's one. That's work ethic. Now, the other thing that I see in Boaz, very strong, has to do with what I call gender ethics. Alright? That Boaz treats Ruth, and I would guess if he treats Ruth this way, he's going to treat other women this way as well. But he treats Ruth with honor, not as an object, not as property. So let me show you where I'm getting at. First of all, we need to remember the cultural context that they're living in, where it's expected, it's the norm is the women are at the mercy of the men. Now, if you have a merciful, a man of chesed, a man of noble character, yeah, he's going to take care of, make sure that you protect, provide for the women. But there are lots of risks. I mean, you guys, Genesis 12, what's going on in Genesis 12? Remember a story about a guy named Abram and his wife Sarai? They went on a little necessary trip to Egypt.
Here's my sister.
My sister. And the same thing in chapter 20. And Isaac pulls the same stunt in chapter 26. I thought they were supposed to be protecting the women. Deuteronomy 20. I'm not sure if I should bring these up, but here we go. 20 and 21, about how when you go to war, as long as the wars are fought against people from other countries, you can take some of their women as your wives. As long as you marry them, etc. All right. Judges 19, we've already talked about how they're and 21 stories there of they almost wipe out a tribe. Oh no, all we have left is the men. What do we do? Oh, well, there's this festival. There's all these unmarried women dancing at some, you know, festival up north. We'll go and you can go kidnap any of those that you need. Necessity, right? Necessity. And on it goes. That's life. That's culture. That's the world. The world in which they live. All right. But Boaz comes along, and in his first conversation with Ruth, he says, I've already heard about you. And guess what? Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? I hope you... It's pretty obvious. It's not just a matter of... I touched her. I shouldn't have done that. You know, it's much, much more than that. Right? The same thing was intimated back in the story of... I believe it was Abraham and Abimelech. Either that one or Isaac and Abimelech. Where they said, yeah, hey, you know, I didn't touch her. Nobody in my kingdom touched her. So we didn't violate, we didn't harass, we didn't rape. Even when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. See, Ruth and some other unfortunate women are being forced by conditions to be put in this man's world. And so they're at risk. Who's there to protect them? If you're someone like Ruth,
a foreigner,
she should go back to her own people. She should have her brothers, her uncles to protect her. We're under no obligation. That's the world in which they live, even in Israel. And so Boaz says, no, nobody. If you're going to touch her, you're going to talk to me. Okay? And that's a part of him. Long before we get to the point of marriage, that's the attitude that he is putting forward. All right? So, yeah. So what he's doing is uncommon, atypical, not of the world kind of attitude. That's the kind of man he is. All right? So, the world assumes Boaz will be Boaz. You ever hear that?
No.
Boaz will be Boaz.
Boaz will be Boaz. No. Boaz is a man of noble character. That's what God calls us to be, guys. Not Boaz, but men. Men of noble character. All right? We need to talk about this more, folks. Really, really proud of our students. A couple of years ago, really just a year ago, here at Pepperdine, our theater department commissioned the writing and then production of a whole new play. There's a huge international theater festival that goes on in Scotland in the summer, the Ringe Festival. So they entered, they had an Irish playwright write the play for them, and all I can say is, wow. Called The Interference. The Interference. And what the play is about is it starts, it's modern times, but it starts with a young lady texting, calling some of her friends the night after, and she's trying to figure out exactly, trying to remember what happened the night before between her and her friend, the star quarterback on the football team. And it soon becomes clear what happened, and that, you know, it was sort of premeditated. So anyway, it gets into this whole business of the double standard that is just so, so common and just kind of accepted in society. You know, boys will be boys and girls need to say no. So I was very, very proud of these guys, not only for the quality of the show, but the fact that they would pick this up and address this and confront both guys and girls with the sinfulness of what is involved in this and of just sort of, you know, sighing and going on rather than addressing it. And I guarantee you, it's not just a modern problem. This was something that Boaz was concerned about. That the Boaz around Boaz would just be Boaz. And he called for more than that, because he was a man of noble character. And that's what God calls us to be. All right, now, we have 3.5 minutes, and I'm going to throw a huge curveball at you, but it's really to address the last thing that I just talked about, at least in part. So let's put together what it is to have a good name, to have the kind of work ethic that I think Boaz has, his attitude about his wealth and the work that goes with that, and gender ethics. This actually has to do with inheritance. Inheritance. And gender. All right, now, you guys remember. Yeah. Who inherits in the Old Testament?
This is the first male.
Yeah.
First male. Gender, there is
males. Yeah. And there's multiple males. The first one gets twice as much as the others. Yeah. So who does that exclude?
Females.
Females. Who else?
The slaves.
Slaves. Who else?
The wife.
Wife, yeah. Females, slaves, who else?
Widows.
Well, they're females. Foreigners.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So you've got to be an Israelite male to have an inheritance. With the only exception being, if there ain't no boys, then the girls can inherit so long as they marry good Israelite boys and we keep things in the line. That's the only exception that they do. So, notice this in the New Testament. Romans 8, Paul talks about how we are all who have taken on Christ our fellow heirs with Christ. Fellow heirs. It's actually sort of, it's the word heir, and then they put the prefix that means with. We are with heirs. We are fellow heirs. We are co-heirs with Christ. Alright? Galatians 3, you guys know the passage.
We're Abraham's seed heirs.
Yeah, we are Abraham's seed. That comes right after saying what? There is neither Jew nor Greek,
male or female,
slave nor free. See? So who are the ones that excluded? Greeks? Slaves? Females, they didn't get an inheritance. But no, Paul says, we're all heirs of Abraham according to the promise. Not according to the custom of the world that says only the Israelite males get it. No, promise. All right? In Ephesians, what does he emphasize? The mystery. What is the mystery? That even the Gentiles are heirs of the promise. And then you have this interesting passage in 1 Peter 3. It starts off talking about, you know, women, be like Sarah, etc. But then it turns to the husbands in verse 7 and says, treat your wives with respect, recognizing that they are what?
Fellow heirs
with you.
That's true.
It's not that you're the heir and you're responsible for them. which can maybe lead to the attitude of, I'm the important one here, and I'm going to be noble by, you know, in my non-condescending way, making sure I take care of them. No, you are fellow heirs. They are children and heirs just like you are. I think that's supposed to change our attitude about them. All right? And so, here's the challenge I have for us. Brothers, do we really recognize our sisters in Christ as fellow heirs? Do we? And do we regard every single woman? We were supposed to, you know, back in Genesis 1, as simply female versions of the image of God. Yeah, I agree with what Rick Mars was saying Tuesday night. But so often, we still read the New Testament with looking at Genesis 3 rather than Genesis 1 and 2. And I think that this talk, if we understand how important inheritance is in the Old Testament, and then see what they say about inheritance in the New Testament, it might change our outlook on some of these things. All right, so there's my curveball at the end of the class, trying to understand this stuff in culture. Yes, ma'am?
I wasn't in the class yesterday, but did you mention Boaz's mom at all and the impact?
Yes. At the very end, I mentioned that, either it's his direct mom, or, you know, we don't know if they skipped generations, but certainly what they have in the genealogies is right before Boaz.
Yeah.
It's Salmon and Rahab. Yeah.
Boaz might have had this emphasis on respect for women, but as also the fact that, like, the fact she was a foreigner, but she loved God was totally including her in God's people.
Yeah.
Because Rahab saved God's people by protecting the spies, and she was Boaz's mom.
There's so much more there.
Read
the commentaries on the descriptions, what they say about the description of Rahab. Why she is described the way that she is. Yeah, so very, very important. Very, very important. Anything else? I know we're over time and we all want to hurry down the hill to the field house. Again, thank you for your attention. I did all the talking today. But that's a guy.